This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
So I'd like to introduce the next speaker, my buddy, Dr. Neil Mehta. I'm very blessed to be able to recruit, Dr. Mehta a couple years ago to be a partner in HCC, and we can all see his impeccable work ethics and drive and, you know, really becoming an expert in HCC within a very short period of time. And, you know, very, very proud of the fact that you have like three oral presentations next week at ASLD. So his presentation is going to be on liver transplant for HCC. Okay, an update. Thanks, Neil.
Thank you, Francis. Thank you. It really is a privilege to be up here speaking with you today. So we'll be doing an update on liver transplantation for HCC, and a lot of this will be piggybacking on some of the stuff that Rio was just talking about. So we're going to talk about the current state of transplantation for HCC. We'll give you updates in our downstaging outcomes, and most importantly, I want to tell you it's time to kind of push past the Milan criteria. So we really need to better refine our selection criteria for liver transplant. So as a lot of you know, the Milan criteria remain the gold standard for allocation of points for liver transplantation. These are patients who have one lesion up to 5 centimeters or 2 to 3 lesions up to 3 centimeters. They can't have macroscopic vascular invasion, and they cannot have disease outside their liver. These criteria have been around for 20 years, and we're still using them. So currently, only patients with HCC LI-RADS 5 lesions meeting T2 criteria, so this is a subset of the Milan group. These are patients who have one lesion 2 to 5 centimeters or 2 to 3 lesions up to 3 centimeters. These are the only patients currently eligible to receive priority listing. Rio just went through the next two, a minimum waiting time of 6 months from listing to liver transplantation, and also a capping of the metal exception score at 34. The first thing I really want to tell you about is the rising incidence of liver transplantation for HCC here at UCSF. So in 2006, we did 22 liver transplants for HCC, and that was about 15% of all of our adult liver transplants were done for HCC. This year, we've done 47% of our transplants are done for HCC, 63 in the first 9 months of this year alone. And so if you extrapolate that out for the whole year, that would be 84 transplants, so four times as many transplants for HCC this year as just 9 years ago. So I think the immediate question that comes to mind is, well, is this a good thing, especially with what Rio was just talking to us about? So a lot of people have started to look at this idea, and really the idea is the transplant survival benefit. So this is a paper that was just published in Gastroenterology this year, a comparison of liver transplant-related survival benefit in patients with and without HCC. So they used the UNOS database of 35,000 liver transplant recipients, and the way they defined transplant survival benefit makes sense. It's that your post-transplant life expectancy minus your waitlist life expectancy. Or basically, if you are, you know, it's pretty easy to figure out post-transplant expectancy. So say you do a transplant and you hope someone lives 5 years. But what if they were going to live 4 years on the waitlist? Well, then that survival benefit's only 1 year. That's not very good. You probably shouldn't transplant that person. So the idea is transplant survival benefit. And what they showed in this study is that the mean 5-year liver transplant survival benefit was significantly lower for HCC than non-HCC patients. But I'll give you this caveat that we think there were some problems with their modeling for the second part, the waitlist life expectancy. I don't think I would necessarily agree with this, but I would say the question is very important, the question of transplant survival benefit, and how do we optimize this for patients with HCC? Well, we have two options, right? We can either modify the post-transplant life expectancy or the waitlist life expectancy. So we'll start with waitlist life expectancy, and this is pretty easy. This was what Rio was just talking about. So one option is to decrease the priority for HCC patients with a very long waitlist life expectancy. If there's an HCC patient that probably would be on the list for 4 or 5 years, one of these small, well-treated tumors, well, probably this is a patient we probably shouldn't give as much priority to. So these are our criteria for the low dropout risk. We presented this here at NAPA 2 years ago, and it's now been published. So patients who have a single lesion, 2 to 3 centimeters, so this is the bottom tumor burden of T2 criteria. Patients who have a complete response to first treatment, and they also have to have an AFP after first treatment of less than 20. If they have all three of those factors, their risk of dropout from the waitlist within 2 years is under 2%. And this makes up 20% of the cohort here at UCSF, versus the dropout risk for all other patients is nearly 30%. Okay, so one option that Rio's talking about and hopefully we'll get through is decreasing priority for these patients. That should improve transplant survival benefit. Now, the other side of the story is not as easy. What about post-transplant life expectancy? How do we improve post-transplant life expectancy for patients with HCC? Well, Francis and I think it's time to move past one size and number fits all in the selection of candidates with HCC for liver transplantation. So how do we better... So the Milan criteria has been around for 20 years. How do we get past this and start to really refine our selection criteria? Because the goal needs to be to decrease HCC recurrence to improve post-transplant survival. So here's a scenario. Your patient with a 3.5-centimeter HCC is at the top of our waiting list and is expecting a liver offer at any time. So today in clinic, he asks you what his expected outcomes after transplant are. And so one option is to answer him with, you know, the standard data. So, sir or ma'am, you're within Milan criteria. We think your 5-year post-transplant survival is around 75%, and we think there's around a 15% chance that you're going to have recurrence. Well, I would argue that that doesn't make any sense. I would say that you can't really determine his outcomes based on that limited amount of information. So what I would argue is that there's several other things that are that happen on the waitlist that we have to take into account. So what about his response to local regional therapy so far? What's his AFP? What was his wait time to transplant? And was he downstaged? So these are the four issues that we're going to focus on now. Once you figure out these four issues, then you can really give this patient a sense of their actual 5-year post-transplant survival and recurrence. So starting with downstaging, downstaging is a reduction in the size of tumors using local regional therapy to meet acceptable transplant criteria. The tumor response to downstaging is based on the radiographic measurement of the size of viable tumors. So what you can see here is a patient who had ablation. Well, you don't want to count the entire size of the lesion. You only want to count the residual enhancing component. So in terms of our UCSF downstaging protocol, patients can be included if they have a single lesion greater than 5 centimeters, but not greater than 8 centimeters. Patients who have 2 or 3 lesions up to 5 centimeters with a total tumor diameter up to 8 centimeters can also be included, as can patients with 4 or 5 lesions, none greater than 3 centimeters, also with an 8-centimeter total tumor diameter cutoff. Patients can have vascular invasion on imaging to be included. And if a patient undergoes local regional therapy and is downstaged to within Milan criteria, after a minimum waiting period of 3 months, they can undergo deceased donor transplant. And if they're downstaged to within UCSF criteria, after 3 months, they can undergo live donor transplant. So Francis recently published this in Hepatology just a few months ago. We had 122 consecutive patients at UCSF in this protocol, and the endpoint of downstaging was residual tumor within Milan criteria. He then compared this group of 122 patients with 488 who were always within Milan. And within the downstaging group, the time from first downstaging procedure to transplant, the median was 10 months. So how do these patients do? Well, the easy answer is that they do very, very well. They do exactly the same as patients who are always within Milan criteria, with a 5-year post-transplant survival of 80% after a median post-transplant follow-up of 4 years. They also had excellent recurrence-free probability of 91%, which is basically the same as patients who are always within Milan. So at UCSF, downstaging works wonderfully. The question is, now that Region 5 has adopted this protocol, were our single-center findings reproducible? This is data that we presented at ASLD last year and will also update this year as well. So we collected 187 patients, both at our center as well as CPMC and Scripps. And successful downstaging, again, was defined as patients who were able to be to have residual tumor, viable tumor within Milan criteria. 58% of the group were able to undergo liver transplant at a median of 13 months from first downstaging procedure. And probably because of our long wait times, they had favorable explant characteristics. Basically, if you downstage someone but transplant them right away, you know, the people who don't have favorable characteristics and who may recur, they don't have a chance to drop out. So in our group, 81% were within Milan. Only 6% had microvascular invasion, and only one person had poorly differentiated tumor grade. So in these three centers, the 1 and 5 year post-transplant post-transplant survival, sorry, was 95% and 80% with a median follow-up of 4 years. So extremely good results and comparable, very good compared to patients who were always within Milan. And similarly, our recurrence-free probability in the whole in all three centers were one in 5 years were 95 and 87%. So basically, we were able to successfully downstage 60% of these patients, and we saw excellent post-transplant outcomes. And importantly, there were no center-specific differences between the three groups. So that's one take-home message, that in Region 5, downstaging works. The other question is, really, what about the other 40%? Can we better refine our selection criteria for entry into the protocol by looking at the 40% who failed? And what we did is we defined treatment failure as dropout due to tumor progression, whether either someone who progressed before they ever made it to Milan, or who made it to Milan and then progressed, or patients who had a liver-related death without transplant, or patients who were able to get to transplant but then had recurrence. All of these groups we coded as treatment failures. So when we look at the 187 patients, 17% of them were never able to be downstaged to Milan. So that has nothing to do with wait time. That's basically those 17% probably would be the same in New Orleans or Spain. That is independent of wait time. Now, once patients were able to be listed, 37 of them did drop off the wait list. The majority were due to tumor progression, as well as 9 patients who had a liver-related death without transplant. And then 11 patients, or 10% of those undergoing transplant, had HCC recurrence. And so when you combine those four groups, we had 79 patients who failed, and about 42% of the cohort. And there were only two predictors of treatment failure on multivariable analysis. So the first was patients who had Child-Pugh B or C disease had a 1.6 increased risk of treatment failure as compared to those with Child-A disease. Even more importantly was the group with the high AFP. So patients who had an AFP before their first downstaging treatment of greater than 1,000 had a hazard ratio of 3.3 for treatment failure as compared to those with an AFP of under 1,000. So when you look at this as risk factors, patients who had no risk factors, only 33% had treatment failure. Patients who had one of these two risk factors, slightly more, 46% had treatment failure at 5 years. But really the group that we are most interested in are the ones who had both risk factors. So if you have both Child's B or C disease as well as an AFP greater than 1,000 before first treatment, it's a small group, but 100% of those had treatment failure within 2 years. And we kind of think that these patients should be excluded from the downstaging protocol. So shifting gears from downstaging, I want to talk about alpha-fetoprotein. So again, the idea being, can we better answer these numbers for this specific patient? So Bilal Hamid last year published in Liver Transplantation on our experience with AFP right before transplant. And basically what he showed is that patients who had an AFP under 1,000 at the time of transplant, their 5-year survival was 80% versus only 52% with an AFP of greater than 1,000. So what he showed is that if you were to exclude those patients with an AFP of greater than 1,000, it's only 5% of the group, but you would actually decrease your center's recurrence by 20%. And so as a lot of you know, we now have a policy here at UCSF that if your AFP is ever over 1,000, it has to come down to under 500 with local regional treatments to be eligible for liver transplantation. So, and I think a lot of us know this, and yes, an AFP at greater than 1,000 is too high. But really another question is, when does the risk first start? Your patient might be, you know, sitting in your office with an AFP of 53, and you really want to be able to tell him, is that too high? Is that worse than a patient with an AFP of 4? And so we did a multi-center study. We had 720 liver transplant recipients here at UCSF, as well as Mayo, Jacksonville, and Rochester. And what we found is the risk of recurrence begins to increase with an AFP at transplant of 20. And this was 30% of the cohort. So 70% of our patients are going to transplant with an AFP under 20, but the other 30% are at increased recurrence risk. So what you can see here is that if their AFP is 21 to 99, they have almost a twofold increased risk of recurrence. And if their AFP increases and it's greater than 1,000, now they have a 4.5-fold increased risk of recurrence. So that was our three centers. What about the whole UNOS database? Well, you can see 5 lines here, and the blue and the red lines for post-transplant survival are excellent. The blue line is patients who don't have HCC, and the red line is patients who have an AFP of 0 to 15 at transplant. Now, the really interesting thing here is that patients who are in the AFP of 16 to 65 category, their risk is significant. Their post-transplant survival is significantly worse than patients who have an AFP of 0 to 15. So, yes, 1,000 is too high, but remember, 16 to 20 is high. It's important to take into account. What about wait time to transplant? So as Rio told us, the median wait time from listing with MELD exception to transplant varies remarkably by UNOS region. As you know, we're here in Region 5, which has the longest wait time for MELD exception to transplant. And so there have been three UNOS-based studies looking at wait time and post-transplant survival. I just picked one to show you. But this was in hepatology this year. So I want you to focus on the top right. So the blue line is two regions with short waiting time. So this is regions 3 and 10 they picked. Their wait time from first MELD exception to transplant was just under 2 months. And they compared their outcomes to patients in the long wait time region, or patients in our region and region 9 with a wait time to transplant of just under 8 months. And what they showed is a small but significant difference in post-transplant survival. 69% of patients were alive 5 years in the long wait time region versus 65% in the short wait time region. And the theory here is that short waiting time leads to patients with aggressive tumor biology who may have dropped out, but instead now they're having early recurrence and worse overall survival. Well, you know, certainly survival is not the same as recurrence. That's one problem with these studies. And another problem is that they're based on the date of listing with MELD exception, which is not as accurate as using date of diagnosis. And so Mary Pat Pauly presented last year at ASLD on her Kaiser's experience with almost 300 liver transplant recipients for HCC at 8 different centers, and she did use date of diagnosis. Good job. Her wait time was of less than 6 months from HCC diagnosis to transplant, was predictive of HCC recurrence on univariate analysis, but did not remain significant on multivariate analysis. So we have since done a multi-center study with over 900 listed patients with HCC, of which over 750 have undergone transplant. And we picked these three centers to represent the variety here. So UCSF long wait time, Mayo Rochester medium wait time, and Mayo Jacksonville short wait time. So overall, a third of our patients who underwent transplant were in waited less than 6 months. Just over half waited 6 to 18 months, and greater than 18-month wait time was seen in 14%. Not surprisingly, 85% of the patients who dropped out were at UCSF. And importantly, when only pre-transplant factors are considered, and the reason that's important is because, yes, you can look at microvascular invasion as an excellent predictor of recurrence, but we have no idea if a patient has microvascular invasion going into transplant, so it's not as useful to use that. So if you only focus on pre-transplant modifiable factors, a wait time of less than 6 months or greater than 18 months, as well as an AFP of greater than 400 at diagnosis, were the only two factors predicting HCC recurrence. So what did that look like? So at 5 years after recurrence, up here, these are the patients who are transplanted outside of what we're calling the sweet spot. These are patients who are transplanted within 6 months or after 18 months. Their risk of recurrence was 16%, or 60% higher than the patients who were transplanted within our sweet spot of 6 to 18 months. So what I want to, so our working theory is that the wait time sweet spot allows for exclusion of patients with overly aggressive tumor biology. So you got to wait 6 months, but then you really want to transplant them before their good biology turns bad. Okay, so 6 to 18 months we think is the sweet spot. Now the last category I think we can use to help refine our selection criteria is response to local regional therapy, and I'll just show you two quick studies. The first is a single-center study from the Mayo group in Rochester, where they looked at basically response to chemoembolization. And down here, you can see TACE responders. So these are people who either had a complete response or a partial response to chemoembolization. And those patients after transplant only had a 5% recurrence risk versus patients who either had stable disease or progressive disease after transplant had an 18% risk of recurrence at 5 years. So quite a significant difference here. And the other study is very interesting. It was a multi-center study of 6 centers in Europe, 400 patients, 3/4 of which were within Milan. And they identified, I want to focus your attention on these two risk factors. So they identified radiologic tumor progression. So basically a patient gets chemoembolization or RFA, and they actually have progressive disease. They either have an increase in the size of that treated lesion, or they have new lesions that pop up. So that was one risk factor, as well as an AFP slope risk factor of 15. So if you check your AFP 3 months apart and it's gone up by around 50 or higher, then that patient also would satisfy that risk factor. So what they showed is that if you don't have any risk factors, it doesn't matter if you're within Milan or not. Your five-year recurrence-free survival is 90%. So throw the Milan criteria out the window. The Milan is important, though, if you do have these risk factors. So survival goes down to 68% if you're within Milan, and really concerning, if you're beyond Milan with one of these risk factors, your five-year recurrence-free survival is only 42%. So in summary, nearly half of all adult transplants at UCSF are now being done for HCC. So if we're going to do that many, we have to make sure that we're optimizing transplant survival benefit. One size and number does not fit all. The Milan criteria is too simplistic. In terms of downstaging, our post-transplant outcomes are equivalent to those always within Milan at UCSF, and we've also shown excellent post-transplant results in throughout Region 5. And if you're going to worry about treatment failure, which we should, then maybe we should be excluding patients who have both an AFP of greater than 1,000 as well as Child's B and C disease. There's also several factors known prior to liver transplant that can modify a patient's risk of HCC recurrence after transplant. We think the risk is clearly increased by having a higher AFP at transplant, and I will tell you that risk starts as low as a patient with an AFP of 16 to 20 and rises as the AFP rises. And also, the risk of recurrence goes up with a poor response to local regional therapy. Finally, the risk of post-transplant HCC recurrence is likely increased by performing a transplant outside the sweet spot wait time of 6 to 18 months from HCC diagnosis. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Neil. Very nice job. Questions for Dr. Mehta? Yes, Marina.
Would you use this criteria to treat the patient post-transplant differently in terms of how you monitor the patient, how you immunosuppress the patient?
The question was, would you use these four criteria, like AFP or wait time, and how differently in terms of monitoring patients and possibly even immunosuppression? I think it's an excellent question. We don't yet, but we probably should. So at UCSF, we do have a policy on who we monitor for HCC recurrence and also in who we would consider switching from tacrolimus-based immunosuppression to everolimus-based immunosuppression, and that is currently not based on really those four factors. We do use an AFP at transplant as one of those factors, so that does include it. We do use things like microvascular invasion in that. We used increased explant tumor burden. So we do use some of them, but I would kind of argue that we could do better. Certainly, our wait times, none of us have to worry about less than 6 months, but we get a little nervous when I think Rio's right that, yes, we should be delaying at least 6 months, but what if that pushes everyone to start waiting 18 or 24 months and we start seeing our recurrence spikes? That's a little concerning, but certainly the response to local regional therapy is one that we probably should take more seriously than we do, though. I will tell you at UCSF, if patients have progressive disease or poor response to local regional treatment, they're never going to make it to transplant.
Yes.
Many of the poorly differentiated carcinoma, they're not even produce AFP. Generally speaking, the poorly differentiated have worse outcome. So how do you correlate those two things?
Yeah, so the question was about poorly differentiated tumors, that a lot of them have a normal AFP, but they may have worse outcomes after transplants. I think that's a really good question. Some centers like the University of Toronto actually have a protocol in place. If they are worried about, if they have patients outside Milan criteria, they actually will biopsy them and exclude patients who have poorly differentiated tumor biology. We really focus here on tumor biology more than, because we don't have access to the poorly or well or moderately differentiated. We don't know that prior to transplant. So we really focus on tumor biology. And if a patient has a rising AFP or progressive disease after local regional treatments, well, those are patients who are going to drop out and never make it to transplant. But you're right that if you had access to knowing if they were poorly differentiated, that may affect how you treat that patient, but we just almost never know that before transplant.
Yeah. Unreal. Yeah.
Okay, I have a question about the downstaging a tumor. When you downstage one large lesion, 7 or 8 centimeters versus 4 or 5 lesions, is the post-op, I mean, chemotherapy survival is the same for both of them?
So the question was about downstaging, about the three different groups. One is the one lesion, 5 to 8, versus 4 to 5 lesions. The caveat is only about 10% of our patients fall into that 4 to 5 lesion category. But when we do look at number of lesions at prior to first downstaging, there was no effect on survival. So it doesn't matter which of those three groups you're in, they all do well. So maybe Francis can also comment on this, but we have an all-comers protocol that we're studying right now. So basically we're saying, well, what if you don't fall into the downstaging protocol? We have an all-comers protocol where anyone without vascular invasion can be enrolled into with basically no upper limit of tumor size, but we haven't had that much luck with that group. Most of them will drop out, but we are studying that idea.
Talking about HCV recurrence, have you find any correlation between the number of treatment sessions using local regional therapy to get them down with AFP less than 40 or within 5 minutes?
Yeah, so excellent question. So the question was about how many is number of local regional treatments predictive of recurrence? And as best as we can tell, both in the downstaging group and in patients always within Milan, that number of local regional treatments received is not predictive of recurrence. Though the question is a little tricky because as your wait time goes up, you're going to have more local regional treatment. So it's hard to distinguish those two factors, but in general, we haven't seen a result. Though, yes, if a patient needs more and more treatments, that patient has a higher risk of falling off the list, and then you'll never see recurrence.
Yeah, was the increased mortality in your Charles Cross B and C in any way reflect the poor tolerance of veteran patients?
So people kind of say, well, those two things are totally. Oh, sorry. The question was, Child's B and C patients with having worse outcomes with in the downstaging protocol, more treatment failure. We do think that's exactly the case. That patients who are Child's B and C, it's not necessarily so much that they're having dropout because of tumor progression. It's that they're a lot of it may be that they're not able to get. You know, as much, you know, they might be getting super selective taste, which may not be as effective, for example. You know, we'd like to look at that exact issue in terms of the specific, you know, responses to treatment and you know, that issue, but we haven't looked at it yet. But yes, that is the, that is our working theory.
So I just want to make one comment. I think that we are developing this risk score. We call it the RESIST. That stands for risk estimate. Retreat. I'm sorry, a risk estimation for what is it?
Tumor recurrence.
Tumor recurrence after liver transplantation. So it's basically addressing the question that Marina asked. Like, you know, maybe there's a gradient based on both pre-transplant clinical variables and also explant tumor characteristics like vascular invasion, and so you can stratify who would likely recur after transplant, and then. Maybe in the future when we have adjuvant therapy that we can apply, there may be a benefit that we can identify the groups of patients. So, but thank you. Thank you, Neil.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.